and welcome to another episode of Just Us Talking, where it is Just Us Talking. Today's episode is about a very interesting topic. It is about frameworks and standards and how we're getting to a place where there's almost a conversation about one framework to rule them all. It's not really my topic. It's a topic of my guest today, Akshay Anand. Akshay and I go back, I'm going to say at least 10 years, but the way we are connected is a very interesting story. I'm going to let Akshay explain that part to you. Akshay, first of all, welcome, and why don't you go ahead and tell us something about yourself.
Thank you for having me on the podcast, first of all, and to your audience, hello everyone. My name is Akshay Anand. I've been in service management for probably about 20 years now. I used to work in the States back when Bearing Point existed, and most of that team moved to KPMG, and that's sort of my connection with Saurabh, because I left around that time, moved to the UK, continued in the service management space, and now I work for a company called Axelos, which might not be a familiar name to a lot of you, but it's the company that manages ITIL, Prince2, MSP, which is Managing Successful Programs, and a whole host of other best practice frameworks. And I am the product ambassador for ITIL. And fun fact, when I left, Saurabh joined that team at KPMG. And I didn't know Saurabh until I ran into my old team at, what was it, Knowledge 12.
Yeah, in New Orleans.
That's right. So that's when I first met Saurabh. And, you know, Saurabh's first complaint was, everybody thinks that I'm a you. It's like, we just replaced one Indian guy with one moderately heavy set, very handsome Indian guy with glasses and a goatee with another moderately heavy, very handsome Indian guy with glasses and a goatee. And everyone, his biggest complaint was, everyone keeps telling him, remember that project that we did? And he's like, no, that wasn't me.
No, and that's true, because there was a point of time, like, it stopped now, because the only person who stays still around from those days is actually Adam. But from the folks who were around for a long time, there were people who would remind me of parties you guys went to. And I'm like, that sounds like an awesome experience. Didn't have it with me. Like, I didn't go there with you guys.
You want to hear a funny story of what happened when I moved to the UK? Mm-hmm. So my first winter here, right, working at one of the big Indian outsourcers. So I'm sitting in the office in London. This is, probably early, mid-December. And I'm working away very quietly. And suddenly this guy walks up to me and he's like, you had a lot of fun at the party last night. And I'm like, I was home watching Mastermind. So I don't know what you're talking about. It's like, no, you had a... he had a great time. And then he walks a little closer and then he like peers at me. He's like, oh, you're not so-and-so. I was like, dude, come on. Again. And the really weird thing is I then tracked down the person. Like 6 months later, we both happened to be in the same office. I swear to you, it was like looking in a mirror.
I want to be clear, right? For anybody who's listening to us, we're not complaining that all Indian guys look alike by any means. But if you put like a package together of what we do, right? So as of right now, if you could see us, both Akshay and I are, like he said, moderately heavyset, both moderately handsome, both wear glasses, both have a bit of a beard, slightly roundish face, both right now have almost shoulder length hair. He's got a little longer hair than me. He's got a Guns N' Roses t-shirt right now, and I have a Bon Jovi message right behind the wall. So both of us are into music. Back in 2012, 13, when this was happening, both of us had been kind of the early adopters of mobile technologies and advanced mobile technologies. So we were kind of proponents of that space. And we were already looking at upcoming technology trends and upcoming frameworks at that time. So it was like, other than the fact that it's a different person, it is the same person, right? It's the same experience that you were getting when you were talking. Yes. So, but talking on that, on the concept of the same experience, see what I did there? So Akshay and I wanted to talk today about a very interesting topic. This is one of those things, as you guys know, Just Us Talking is about two guys just talking about something that has two sides to a conversation. And you know, we both like the topic, so we're going to talk about it and just some pros and cons type conversation. So this is one that more recently I've heard a lot more about. Many clients, at least on the professional side, have started talking about this whole concept of we want one experience, the unified experience or single experience has become a big deal. It's coming from a lot of places. And that's a topic that I believe we need to probably open a few layers on, because there's why do people like it? Why should they like it or should they not like it? And really, what is the concept? So Akshay, why don't you start with, how would you describe the conversation, the topic itself?
Well, the Great Frameworks War has a certain ring to it. And I use the word ring very deliberately there, because when I do talk about this at various conferences, I actually use a picture of the One Ring from Lord of the Rings, and I talk about, you know, the fact that we are all chasing that one framework to rule them all. I think it's a beguiling idea that there is one framework which will help harassed managers and practitioners who are stressed out every day trying to deliver not only their day-to-day jobs, but also find enough time to pitch in on projects, on improvement activities, on corporate social responsibility initiatives, etc., etc. It's very beguiling to think that there's this mythical, mystical framework out there that can solve everything. And I think a lot of consultants and tool vendors, present company accepted, of course, but a lot of consultants and tool vendors and practitioners in the field are also, in a way, promoting the idea that there is that framework. And I think this is where some of the danger starts to creep in, because, you know, you go to a conference or a virtual conference these days, and you see an idea about how waterfall project management is dead, or it's evil, or whatever it might be, right? There are no subtleties with some of these titles and some of the content, right? It's all or nothing on some of these talks. But then you come back to your company, your day job, and the next time somebody starts talking about, you know, the aims of a project or something like that, you then say, but I just saw this amazing presentation, really funny, and it was really thought-provoking, which said that waterfall is dead. So we're going down the wrong path. The thing is, different methods suit different contexts. And this is the nuance that everybody misses, or a lot of people miss. Waterfall is correct in a specific context. Agile is correct in a specific context. ITIL is correct in a specific context. COBIT is correct in a specific context. You name whatever that framework is, it is correct in a specific context. Or there might be multiple contexts in which it is applicable. And equally, there are certain contexts in which that framework, that methodology or approach is not applicable. So I've spent the last 4+ years on the conference circuit, so to speak, right? Spoken at a lot of conferences. I mean, even before that, back when I was at Bearing Point, et cetera, mm-hmm. you know, I was going to some of the American conferences, but my role in the last few years has expanded quite a bit. So I've been going to a lot of conferences around the world. And one of my pet peeves is that conferences and practitioners don't like to share stories of failure. Understandably so. Nobody wants mm-hmm. to stand up in front of the stage and say, yeah, we kind of screwed the pooch on that one. Right? People want to talk about their success. I get it.
True.
But at the same time, think back as a child, as an adult, entering the workforce. You know, it's not like you graduated from college and you knew everything that you needed to know to do your job. You made mistakes, but you were able to learn from those mistakes, or indeed somebody was able to point out those mistakes and say, look, this is why you didn't succeed. This is what you need to do in order to be able to succeed. And what I'd like to see more of in a lot of these conference talks and a lot of these thought leadership pieces is people saying, look, we tried this, it didn't work, we didn't get there, but we tried something else, or we changed what we set out to do and we succeeded, right? Because what we see as a result is this survivor bias of frameworks mm-hmm. and methods, right? there's a story, I'm not sure how, whether it's like a myth that's grown up over time, or I think I read about it in Wikipedia, and as we all know, Wikipedia is correct. But there's a thread in Wikipedia about survivor bias, which talks about how back in World War II, a group of engineers looked at planes that had returned from bombing runs or dogfights, to see how they could reinforce the new planes so that they wouldn't be shot down. And they looked at where all the holes were, and they added more armor in those spots. Okay. But the thing is, those planes survived despite the holes being in those spots. The planes that didn't survive got holes in everywhere else. Right? So okay. We need stories of failure. We need to examine stories of failure, sometimes more than stories of success, to understand what works and what doesn't work. So coming back to the point about the frameworks, we need to understand that, for example, a bureaucratic, top-down, controlling change management process, for lack of a better example, we need to understand that it's not fit for purpose in all situations. There might be something so significant, so risky, that you do want that careful coordination and sort of gentle type of movement, as opposed to the very rapid velocity of deployments that you might see in another context. So we need to understand how frameworks originated, what domain they originated from, to understand how they can be applied. And there are some frameworks that, to an extent, transcend. I think service management frameworks do a reasonably good job of transcending out of operations and talking about other aspects of service management. I think you can twist big A Agile a little bit to be able to get a perspective on what small A Agile is. What does it mean to be an agile enterprise? You know, a lot of the principles of agile software development hold true, but you've got to now scale it up to talking about the whole enterprise and sort of saying we're measuring our feedback cycles are not daily or time boxed, short time box iterations. Our feedback cycles are 3 months, 6 months, or even a year. And so because of that, we have to adopt different techniques. We have different levels of risk appetite, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry, I'm ranting and monologuing at this point.
So I'm going to... This is perfect, because I actually do have some notes in this context, right? So let's start with the first one. You talked about conferences and how conferences are more and more, they're like victory dances, right? They're like, this is what's successful, this was successful, this was successful. And part of your concern or other question is, well, great, you learned from that, but where's the failure that you also learned from? Now, to that one, I think part of this is we are the inability of humans or us as people to segregate personal accomplishment or a story of personal accomplishment with a story of personal learning, right? This is the human side of things. I was doing this exercise where I was talking to the team about, my internal team about, how do we help our people track their growth, right? Their learning. And learning cannot be tracked by just looking at how many projects you've gone through. Because, well, if I said it's, you can learn up to 100% in an area, that's a logarithmic expression or calculation. You will never learn everything there is in a specific area.
But just number of projects isn't adequate, because you might just be making the same mistake or the same set of mistakes in every project. So, just the number of years of experience is not adequate.
Exactly. And the key part there was, it is actually very much possible and very much real to say that if you fail in your first project, or you perform poorly in your first project, where let's say you were working, you took change management as an example, I'll use the same, you were doing a change management track leader role and you bombed because you didn't know much. I am guaranteeing you, by the time you were done, you learned way more than you walked in with. So a learning experience comes a lot more from failure. However, back to the conferences conversation, we find it difficult to break apart the concept of my performance or my growth from the concept of my learning, which are two different things. I can learn a lot, but not perform great. And the second side of that conversation is pretty much every conference these days is a sales pitch, disguised inside, you know, some other experiences and stories, etc. Like, I agree with you. I would love to actually see a conference where there's a track just focused on failures, right? Tell me that you did this project and you failed. And we will put a combined thought in the room with you. And by we, I mean just a crowdsourced answer to this. That'll say, well, did you try this? Could you try that? Would that have worked? And let it be a giant brainstorming session as opposed to a session where I walk in, I say, this was awesome, we did this, we ran into this, you know, fake technicality of problem, and this is how we overcame it. Yeah, overcoming a technical problem like that is a great thing, but it's not the same as, you know, failing and learning that you failed. Like, there's a straightforward example. I've actually been on a project, spent a year working that project, delivered every single thing that was supposed to get delivered, and yet I consider the project a failure because we just weren't ready to actually run with that thing going forward. So I had a technical baked solution ready on a shelf, or actually forced people to use it to some extent, but the people who I built it for weren't ready to get to that level. That's a failure that we need to be able to account for and say, yes, that's a mistake.
I was going to say that we shouldn't be afraid of the sales pitch, right? Because sometimes we are promoting the brand. The thing is, by speaking at a conference, we are promoting the brand of the conference. We're promoting the brand of our employer, perhaps. If we're speaking about a project that we did at our employer or for a client, we're promoting that brand. And we're promoting our personal brand because we want to grow our own brands, our own profiles, so that we can, you know, build our network, find the next interesting career move, etc., etc. So I don't mind the sales pitch aspect of it, but I think there's a wider issue here that, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about like our school going days versus, you know, what it's like in corporate life. At our school going days, failure is tolerated so much more. Failure is regarded as an awesome opportunity to learn. Now, different people's experiences may vary. That was mostly my experience, that I had good teachers who were willing to step in and help me understand why I had failed and how to avoid failure later on and so on. But the moment we graduate from university or college and enter the workforce, failure is not an option. That is drilled into people from the get-go.
I'm going to give you just a quick sidebar on that one, because this is, so I have this theory that everybody's got, you know, a front part of the brain that you use to have a conversation, and then the back part of the brain is the smartass who kind of just throws in random things. So when you were saying this, my first reaction from the back part of that brain was, yes, because at school, somebody was being paid to tolerate your failure. In work, somebody's paying you to not fail.
At work, somebody's paying your manager to ensure that despite your failures, you might succeed in the short term, and they are building a long-term, sustainable, competitive differentiation.
You're talking about an ideal case situation. I'm talking about the realistic side of things. I love the perspective that you have on this, because I wish that's how most organizations work. You and I have been lucky to have those kind of organizations around us. Shameless plug, but yes, it's true, right? Not everybody does. And that's why a lot of people, a lot of our clients in that context are very, you know, success oriented. And well, not to say success orientation is bad, but success at any cost oriented. Let me bring us back to our topic. Sure. Right? The other topic we were talking about was the whole, the right sizing or the right positioning of every framework for every situation, right? Part of this, I completely get. In the context of, so I was looking at this product management training recently, and there was a perfect example somebody used, and I was like, how did I never think of this? Agile versus waterfall context, right? In most hardware deployments, right, you don't actually have the choice to go agile. What are you going to do? Create an iPad, release it, and then release an enhancement, hardware enhancement to that iPad? You're not going to do that. So waterfall is there, and it's there for a specific target. Agile And this is where your big A agile and small A agile kind of resonated with me, because I was like, you can be an agile enterprise in the way you release a hardware product. To be honest, the company I'm thinking of when I say that is Tesla, right? They released a product. They were fairly agile about it because they created spaces where they could add things. Upgradability was possible. But yes, after a point of time, you just got to buy a new car, right? But you don't have to be software agile or software waterfall when you're working in that space. So hardware and software, waterfall and agile is kind of a straightforward example of where right sizing is required. I'm taking this part, this conversation to the next level, where when we talk about one framework to rule them all, my question is this a difference between saying frameworks are focused on specific areas versus frameworks are broadening themselves to pick up other areas that do not traditionally belong to them, right? So if I took an example of not some specific framework, but let's say a framework focuses traditionally on a specific area. And as we have evolved as organizations, as companies, those areas have evolved. We've become a much more connected world in general, right? So saying just the DevOps principles, if I go back to them, right? DevOps was DevOps, then became DevSecOps, then there's DevSec something else ops, and now there's like people have just gone given up, so they're like, now it's XOps, so you can put whatever else you want in front of it. So with that kind of a mindset, if a framework starts expanding in itself and starts getting into that space, what's the harm in having that context of, because it'll be simpler, then you won't have framework wars to start off with, but it will be at a place where you'll be able to look at things and have a perspective on them while they're still connected. And just for my own sanity's sake as a consultant, you would have less things to worry about. New frameworks popping up every other day, which is the kind of the statement.
There's a lot to unpack there, all right? And you may have to repeat the question several times for me to be able to unpack everything. But I think for me, there are two themes that we need to make sure people understand. The first is frameworks equals scaffolding.
Okay.
All right. So frameworks are the scaffolding that allow you to grow your specific ways of working for your products, your services, your internal capabilities, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. But once you've built that, the scaffolding either gets absorbed into your system, so it's no longer visible, or you dismantle that scaffolding because what you've created is able to run by itself. Okay.
Yep.
And the scaffolding analogy works beautifully. If you think of when you construct a house, some of that scaffolding is what you typically associate that word with, right? It's the poles and the planks that are on the outside of the house that allow mm-hmm. workers to go up and lay bricks and roofing and windows and all the other good stuff. And when the house is built, that scaffolding comes down and gets taken away. There's another type of scaffolding, which is the joists and the cavities between the ceiling of one floor and the floor of the next one above it, which allows workers to be able to crawl into it, to run your wires, your plumbing, your whatever it might be.
Yep.
But that's another type of scaffolding. But that type of scaffolding gets absorbed into the overall structure of that house, right? So we mm-hmm. can think of frameworks in the same way. Some frameworks help give you a structure on which you can say, maybe we should think about building our accounts payable process based on this best practice framework literature that's out there.
Okay.
But it's a starting point. And then when we have built it, we don't have to refer to that text anymore because we have built something for ourselves that is sustainable and it works, and we don't need to go back to an external reference point unless something breaks down.
Right.
There's a particular product that we're using that, let's say ServiceNow, that ServiceNow platform team are managing the releases of that, but they're using agile methods to release that. We get to know every couple of weeks what changes they've had, and then we mm-hmm. can then we build our accounts payable process around that, and it becomes an integrated part of that, but we don't recognize that Agile is there. It's there somewhere, but we don't see it. Right? Okay. So the first thing that I think a lot of practitioners need to understand is frameworks are scaffolding. They're nothing more than scaffolding. They either become integrated and inherent in your final product, service, or capability, but they're no longer seen, or they're used to build your product, service, or capability, and then they are dismantled and taken away.
You're getting into a space which is giving me a whole new idea for a conversation, right? This is one of those. This is the creativity of this type of conversation with Just Us Talking, that we're not, by the way, anybody who's listening to this should be able to find out and very clearly understand this is unscripted. We have no clue what we're talking about to some extent. The biggest pushback that I have ever heard around frameworks in general comes from startups, right? Any company that's starting up, their first reaction, in the hope of being different, in the hope of being unique and breaking the mold, their first reaction is, yeah, no, frameworks not for us. We'll just do it, right? And so I'm going to the complete opposite of, there's the whole concept of, you know, one ring to rule them all. But now there is, I don't need a ring. I don't need a ring because I have a wand. And that wand is a tool, or that wand is just me with super brain power, and I'm going to take care of it myself. What's your perspective on that mindset, that frameworks are not for us, we're a startup? And I'm focusing on startups in this context.
Okay. So again, I think this was the second point which I was trying to find paper to write down, etc. Frameworks have a reason to be able to expand their scope, which is as technology evolves, certain constraints are removed from the system and certain new constraints are imposed in its place. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the classic example I give with this is, way back in the day, I can still remember floppy drives, right? And box software in your Best Buy and all that sort of stuff, right?
Yep.
That box software was literally burned onto that floppy disk and literally shipped around the world, all right?
I still do that. You know, there are boxes of TurboTax that are available at Best Buy here.
I don't know, man. I'm all about the cloud now. So anyway, but the point is that software was literally shipped around the world, right? So the cost of recall, brand, reputational, whatever, if something was wrong, was astronomical, right? Mm-hmm. Now that we have near ubiquitous broadband in a lot of places, the ability to roll and pull back deployments quickly, etc., that constraint of really long recalls, etc., that constraint has been taken away, but in its place there are now new constraints. So that's why frameworks seem to always expand, because they're trying to adjust themselves for these new constraints, what were previously edge cases.
So is this a race of frameworks in some ways as well, to talk about so let's take this simple example. You and I have stayed in the ITSM space forever, right? The oldest issues that we have faced in the CMDB space was the fact that you had to manage the CMDB. As companies became larger and larger, they started asking us questions how can you automate it? Can we discover it? Can we, do all sorts of things? And initially our answer was, yes, you can discover, but as is versus supposed to are different stories. Now you're in the cloud. Now an organization, going back to the startup, is entirely in the cloud. They don't have the constraint of physical, and cloud management consoles are easily telling them exactly what they have. So the constraint from a process standpoint on the CMDB of the lack of automation or lack of true automation is somewhat gone. So when that happens, if the next framework that goes down that path or that recognizes it evolves and says, so we will, not just talk about, we might be a process-based framework, but we need to introduce cloud as a technology, and the impact or the disruption created by cloud as a technology into it, which is what they would use as their pillar to then expand further, the framework itself. So is this, on that front, is this more of a race of the frameworks and not framework wars, really? Which one gets to it faster?
No, it is a frameworks war, because I think there are people who are promoting singular solutions to organizational issues, whether that's startup issues or multinational enterprise issues. I do want to just complete the last train of thought before I move up to the startup question, right? My experience has been that a lot of frameworks find it hard to dissociate themselves from their origins, whether that's from a brand perspective. Like, ITIL will always be a service desk and ops framework. That is not simply not true, but that is the perspective of a lot of people in the world because that's been their experience with it. Agile will always be a software development framework, although we're seeing it being applied elsewhere. It's fine to own your brand, own your identity that way, right? But as you start to evolve, one of the issues becomes that your mindset does not evolve. I'll give you an example. And listeners out there who are lean IT practitioners, I love you all. I think lean is an amazing framework. It solves a lot of issues. But you're not going to make friends in the service desk and customer support kind of community if you were to tell them that their work is non-valuable or wasted effort.
You mean in the context of how it's framed? Yes. Sometimes
because that is harkening back to the origins of lean, where work that was to fix something on the factory floor should not have been put in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. That was a very mechanistic view of things. But in real life, things will invariably go wrong. You have to have some amount of capacity to be able to fix issues as they come up unexpectedly or not, right? Mm-hmm. So, but the language is not fit for purpose, in my opinion.
Right? It has not been upgraded, is how I would say it.
That is the dark side of frameworks expanding their scope, that it's difficult for them to move away from the language of from their roots, mm-hmm. if you will. Okay, so now coming back to your startup question, I understand where people have this pushback against frameworks, saying it's too onerous, it's too burdensome, it gets in my way, and mm-hmm. that's fine. When you are 1, 2, 5, 10, 20 people, you might find that a lot of the frameworks literature is more effort than is sustainable for your organization.
True.
But you will hit some point, or at your current size, you will hit a use case, which then means you're having to invest effort to try to solve that, when instead of sort of saying, so have other people solve this, right? So I remember some years ago, I was in Estonia, and I was listening to a developer, a CEO of a startup, talking about how they had solved, event logging or something like that from automated to an automated perspective. They wrote their own scripts to parse the logs and blah, 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 blah. And that was great. They found their own solution. It took them 6 months to get to a point where they were happy with that solution. And all the time, I was thinking to myself, well, yeah, but if you spent maybe 1 month figuring out
researching
what best practice around this was like, you could have arrived at that answer quicker, thereby saving yourself those cycles to go away and do something awesome with your product, right? So to those startup CEOs and so on, I'd say yes, if you're one person, creating a form for yourself to be able to fill out just because you want to know what changed, it's onerous, it's too much, right? Obviously. And you might have that when you're 2 people, might have that when you're 5, when you're 20, maybe. But at some point, you will hit a scale of size or scope where you now have to start creating your scaffolding to mm-hmm. be able to join up different parts of your organization. Otherwise, you're going to have sort of the whole right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing syndrome, etc. So there will come a point where you should start looking at how have others solved the issue.
If I stick to your analogy of scaffolding and house and stuff like that, when you're 2 people, you can live in a tent. And it's perfectly fine to create that tent from whatever material you have access to. When you grow up and become a family and there's more people, you want a house. And that requires the scaffolding that would be, that would help you create the structure for the house and actually build it. Now, this is a bit of another shameless plug. So last week I published a blog, which was more of just a take on how startups growing up are like kids growing up. It's very similar. I mean, but if you look at the companies that are startups that have gone to a really large size and they're still working in the way of, again, I'm looking at, I think of products that fall in two different categories. There's what I call startup products or startup attitude and behavior. And then there is the I'm growing up, I'm going to be a big boy tools and frameworks and behavior. When you're starting off, you might be a company that can survive on the, you know, home experience words or whatever the lowest end of Jira usage is. And this is us staying in our comfort space of service management, right? But I know of companies that became decacorns, like $10 billion plus dollar companies, and still preferred everything on Jira, right? They refused to actually acknowledge the fact that putting a framework like ITIL or COBIT or any of those, like, you know, series of frameworks that are applicable to service management will help them. Well, everything's a ticket, just a ticket. That's, I'm good with that. It's one ticket, right? And the interesting part is, if you're living in the world of everything I do is a task, that might be okay, right? Because that basically means everybody is going to get a task and they will do the task. But the reason these frameworks have been created by looking at what better practices have been in the industry is because this is like learning from the experience that you just talked about, right? If I'm not using it and I have an extremely high, for sake of simplicity, you know, risk to reward ratio because my changes are not tested, etc., and everything is just a task that I'm executing against, that could be fine for you as you're a 200 people company. As you get to a 2,000 people company, that's fine too. As you get to a 5,000 people company, you're scaling out of that range, and many things will start kicking in. So I'm in agreement with the whole pushback side of thing that it makes sense. Again, this is back to right sizing, that it makes sense in certain cases of application of framework and in certain sizes, but in certain other situations, we might be in a completely different boat here. Mm-hmm. So, well, actually, thank you very much. I just realized what the time is. We've been talking nonstop and I'm pretty sure.
I could go for another half an hour.
I know we can, but I know that nobody's going to listen to a podcast that shows up as 60 minutes long. So thank you very much, Akshay, for your time. This was an exciting conversation. I have a feeling it has a phase two or a part two conversation that we can pull off later on.
I would love to have me to be back if you'll have me back.
Oh, definitely, man. This is awesome. And plus, it's like talking to myself. Remember what I said earlier. So, well, again, actually, thanks for joining us. Any last words before I close out our conversation?
So obviously, you know, I work for Axelos. Go check out ITIL 4. It's the bee's knees. It's brilliant. But I do want to chuck in a couple of other bits and pieces that build on some of the stuff we talked about. So if you're interested in learning a little bit more about scaffolding and that sort of thing, I learned about that from a guy called Dave Snowden, who talks a lot about the Kinevin framework and complex adaptive systems and stuff like that. It can seem very ephemeral. It can seem very academic. But once you get your mind around it, it will just blow your mind open, and it'll open you up to so many new possibilities of what you can do at work. The other thing, going back to what you were saying, Saurabh, as you start to scale out, another really interesting speaker that I've seen at various conferences, but you can catch it on YouTube as well, is a guy called Simon Wardley, W-A-R-D-L-E-Y, he talks about Wardley mapping, and part of that is talking about how where certain frameworks have the best or the optimized use case. So if you're working in a very nascent agile emergent space, then, you know, agile is great for you. If you're trying to scale up, that means your focus needs to switch to reducing waste, or optimizing, indirect work. So you need to switch to something like lean. And then when you finally industrialize everything and you're running things at scale, then you might need to look at something like Six Sigma or something like that. So there's some really interesting stuff that Simon Wardley talks about around taking that commodity curve to your product and your service, and then figuring out from that perspective what blend of frameworks, approaches, methodologies make sense. So that was what Saurabh was referring to at the very end, and I thought that would be a good thing for people to go away and read about.
Awesome. So thanks, Akshay, again for joining us. And for those who are listening to me, I will see you in a couple of weeks again. Thanks.